All right, friends, Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason, and I am thrilled to see the lines virtually full of callers. Where did you guys come from? Where were you last week? I guess you're having Thanksgiving. I missed you, but I'm glad you're back, and I'll be getting to your calls shortly. I got a haircut yesterday, and I still have some hair left. In fact, most of the hair, virtually all the hair that I've lost, I lost by the time I was about 30 or so, and I've maintained the crop I have since then, but it's changed colors. And, you know, when you get older, you don't like to mess with stuff like that. So I keep it fairly trimmed fairly short, okay? But right now it's so short, it's just a little bit spiky. So I look a little bit wild, which I don't know, may be appropriate. I kind of like it myself, you know. I like to have that kind of military look, you know, just that, who's the NCIS guy? I can't remember his name. You know, my family always watches those. But, you know, that guy. I like the way, so that's me. So, except for now, I'm a little spikier than usual. But I'm still my old friendly self. Listen, I saw a movie last night that I have seen before a long time ago. In fact, I think it was made in 1991, so that's a long time ago. But it got me thinking about something that I talked with the staff about during our mentoring time today, and I wanted to pass on to you as well. And it's the ideas are akin to something I've talked about before. Now, let me set this up by telling you the movie, which some of you may have seen, and I think it's worth seeing. Kinda, if you'd like. It's not one of those must-sees, but there's something in it that I think is valuable. It's a Billy Crystal movie, and he hasn't made any movies for a long time. But the movies he made, I've never been disappointed. I always thought this is a comedian turned actor who made thoughtful choices in movies, and he made choices about things that kind of mattered. The human condition and relationships and stuff like that. And anyway, this was City Slickers. And in the movie, Billy Crystal turns 39, and he's at a point in his life where he is reflecting on where he is, where he's been, and where he might be going. But things are not very satisfying where he's at the moment. So he's going through kind of a midlife crisis. Now, he's got two buddies. And one is the actor Daniel Stern, who you might remember as the taller of the two in the Christmas Story, Home Alone. There it is. I almost said Left Alone. Home Alone. And he was one of the burglars. Okay, that's Daniel Stern character. And Bruno Kirby, who is in a number of Billy Crystal movies, also in When Harry Met Sally, which I thought was an intelligent film about relationships. But in any event, this is a movie about midlife crisis and how these guys are trying to capture or hang on to their youth by once a year doing something crazy, like running with the bulls in Pamplona or parachuting or something, climbing a mountain. Of course, they're getting older, so they're not so good at this. And actually, in the beginning, they don't quite outrun the bulls. So a little spoiler alert there, or at least Billy Crystal doesn't. And he's starting to realize, you know, the years are catching up with him, as they do with everyone. And so the whole movie is about how he deals with this and reconciles this in his own mind. Where is he? Where is he going? What is really meaningful in his life? And he discovers this on a final adventure that the three of these middle-aged guys go on, which is a cattle drive from New Mexico all the way up into Colorado somewhere. So they do the deal. There's about eight people that are part of this program, but they are on their horses. They got to rope cattle. They got to drive the cattle. They eat out of a chuck wagon. They sleep on the ground. They in a tent basically. But it's like the real deal. So they're living like the old west. And of course, Bruno Kirby always plays the overly macho guy, and he's all behind this to do the macho thing. And Daniel Stern is suffering in his marriage, and Billy Crystal doesn't know what he's doing. So this is an event that is meant to bring some definition to these areas of their own lives, and which happens actually as the film unfolds, kind of comically and kind of seriously. And this is why I've liked the Crystal films, because of that. They do examine something that's important, and I've appreciated that. But what this got me thinking about was was midlife crisis. Now, I'm 70, so I'm not in midlife. I'm at the other end, and I'm not in crisis in the way that that people struggle. In fact, I never have had a midlife crisis. I didn't get married till I was, 49. Is that right? I was almost 50? I lose count. Yeah, I was 49 years old when I got married. 48. I had my 49th birthday on my honeymoon. So I got married late in life, and maybe that upset the rhythm of that kind of thing a little bit. But there's something else that's going on for me as a follower of Christ that has been really, really important to me. And I have mentioned one aspect of this in the past, and the aspect that I've mentioned is the idea that that we do not measure our lives by the 80 that we are allotted here in this life, roughly. You know, what is that 80, 85? I don't even know. What's a score? I don't know. But anyway, that's a lifetime. 20? That's what I thought. But 80 is like 90, and most people don't live to 90. Okay, so anyway, that's a lifetime, whatever it is. Your standard, 85 is the lifetime expectancy right now, something like that, the standard thing for men at least. Anyway, the point is that our lives are not defined by that. And what I've talked about before is how if we are getting older and we look back at our life and we think about the things that we would have liked to have done and weren't able to do, the goals that we wanted to accomplish, and now there isn't time to do them or isn't the physical ability to do them. And this can be, or relationships that haven't turned out the way one expected, whether with marriage or with children or with other family members. And so there's always something that has gone wrong. I guess it was John Lennon who said, life is what happens while you're making other plans. A bit of insight there, really. I remember watching a movie many years ago, a black and white film, and there was a scene in it where someone who was reading out of a book, and when they read this book, it was a man and a woman, and they read this line that they pondered, and the line was that our lives are like a diary in which we mean to write one story, but we write another. Our lives are like a diary in which we mean to write one story, but we write another. And that's always the case. People's lives never turn out the way they want. Sometimes they turn out better, sometimes worse, sometimes different. But they never turn out the way we expect they would turn out, which means when you're moving towards the end of your life or halfway through, like in the film City Slickers, and reassessing, there is opportunity for angst. If you feel, if you believe that you are confined by these years, not only confined by these years, but defined by these years. And so as people look back and they are experiencing the regrets that are normal for people to experience, and this is another thing I mentioned once before, people will say once in a while, I mean, you hear this, they said, I got no regrets. I got no regrets. I can't imagine why anybody would say that. Who's got no regrets? Really? You look back on your life and you look at every decision you made, every relationship you had, everything that you did, and you say, I wouldn't have done anything differently? Are you kidding? I can tell you one thing, that's not true for me. I would have done all kinds of things differently. Now, I believe in the sovereignty of God, and He works through all the messes I've caused for myself and for other people, but nevertheless, I got lots of regrets. And there are lots of times I've thought, I wish I could go back to this year or this time in my life or whatever, and have a do-over. Okay? So, people in general start thinking about that, it is an opportunity for depression, especially as there is a lot more sand in the bottom of the hourglass than in the top. And what I had talked about in the past is that one thing that helps me is realizing I'm not stuck in my 80. All the things I wanted to get done, in this lifetime, I will have an eternity of meaningful activity in order to do things that may not be the same thing because, for example, I wanted to learn multiple languages. So I didn't do that. I learned English, which is a really hard one to learn. Although I think about it, one person said it can't be that hard. He knows kids that can speak it, right? But I wanted to learn Spanish really well, and I learned some Thai when I lived in Thailand, but I only went so far. And so, these are desires that probably will never be fulfilled. I can guarantee you I played the best tennis game in my life already. It's downhill from here. In fact, I haven't played for a while. And so, consequently, it would be easy to look at the history and get depressed, except for I know that when I shuffle off this mortal coil, that's not the end of it. There are still meaningful things. I may not learn Spanish in heaven, but there's going to be lots of other meaningful activities to do that will be satisfying without the distraction of the toil that defines work from normal activity. Okay, work came with the fall. Work doesn't mean activity. Activity is satisfying and fulfilling. Work is the toil that is associated with activities, okay? So we will have meaningful stuff. So this is an encouragement to me. I didn't get it all done now, but you know what? I got a long time to do other stuff that's going to be probably a lot more satisfying than the things I wish I would have gotten done in this life. Okay, so that's the half of the observation. And I made this observation a few months ago, and we've talked about it, and maybe that was encouraging to some of you. But in watching City Slickers, I was thinking of another aspect of this, and this other aspect is very meaningful to me. What I'm offering you is not just a homily from a passage, but something that in my own life there's a tremendous amount of currency for, okay? And it has to do with being at a time in my life, and this is, by the way, true at any time, not just, 70, where you're looking at your life and the things that you value in your life are not going like you'd like them to go. And as you get older, it is less and less likely that they will ever get fixed. So this is a specie of what I was talking about first. It's a little variation. And there is a verse that is very meaningful to me when I think about that. I like being productive. I like being industrious. It's one of my values. I think I got it from my dad. I think it's a virtue. I think God values industry in human beings. And in a certain sense, God himself is industrious. He took a mess, tohu wabohu, everything was formless and void, and he put it in order. He ordered it, then he filled it, okay? So I think that when we order things and we are productive and industrious, we are doing something kind of like God does. It's part of the image of God in man. And for me, it's especially satisfying. Now, I don't know about other people. Some people are disorderly, and maybe that's okay with them. But for me, it doesn't feel good. I like putting things in order. And this is, and if you think about it, it's part of what I do for a living. I take ideas and concepts, and I put them in an order that make them, I think, more understandable, accessible, or more useful for people's lives. And especially if I can put those things in order for my life and they're useful to me, then I can pass them on to you. And that's what I'm doing now. Because what I realize about the frustrations that and dissatisfactions I'm having right now, I can still do things that make a deposit of sorts that will pay dividends, even though other things are not going the way I want them to go. All right? So let's say, as an illustration, when you're younger, you are working and you're paying for your bills and stuff, but if you're prudent, you may work extra to sock money away for the future. So you work a few Saturdays, you make a few money, you put it in the bank. And isn't there a kind of sense of satisfaction in doing that? I actually enjoyed working on Saturdays at different times because I realize I'm getting something extra. I'm working extra, but I'm getting something extra I normally wouldn't have gotten. So it changed the temper of that labor on Saturdays, and that could be put aside for the future and kind of earning interest, so to speak. So there's a satisfaction of laying something aside and saving up and having it for some time in the future when I needed it. Very basic concept. I think most of you understand that. Now, Jesus speaks about this, I think it's in Matthew chapter 6 or so, or maybe 7. Sermon on the Mount, maybe, I'm not sure, but you're familiar with the notion because he actually upbraids someone for doing that very thing, but it's a very particular kind of chastisement. The problem with saving is not saving. The problem with saving is thinking that's all there is to life. You have your bank account, you have this, you have that, you're all settled, you're ready to go. Okay, eat, drink, and be merry, because I'm got it all squared away. Now, Jesus called that man a fool. And the reason he called him a fool is because that was his whole life, and he said, tonight your life will be required of you, and none of that goes with you. So my reference to the saving part is not that you build your life by making savings, but the satisfaction that you get from doing something like that has a parallel. There is an analog in the spiritual realm that Jesus was talking about. And he said, do not, here's the principle, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust can destroy and thieves can break in and steal, but rather lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy nor thieves break in and steal. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. Now, he wasn't, I think, inveighing against savings. There's a prudence to that, and the book of Proverbs talks about that. He was talking about how your life is oriented. And so I save. I've got money I'm putting away, and I'm trying to make work for myself because I have responsibilities with a family. I'm not always going to be able to earn what I'm earning now, and I want to make sure that I can take care of my responsibilities as a dad and as a husband. Okay, so, but when I go, that's gone. All right, that's for this life. That's for this 40 and 10, and I see it in its proper perspective. But I am also laying up a different kind of treasure, and I'm doing it consciously, a treasure in heaven. That is, any investment that I make as a Christian in the lives of others, and of course, an obvious example of that is what I'm doing right now and the work I do at Stand to Reason, but it's not just that. I have a family. I'm not on the job when I'm with my family or with others where I am trying to make a difference for the cause of Christ as an individual, not as a professional. So we all have these things in our lives. We all, as followers of Christ, have opportunities to make investments. Now, maybe we're not in full-time ministry, but we are full-time Christians. And Jesus is encouraging us to lay up for the future. Now, here is where this cashes out for me emotionally, because the concepts I've just explained to you, I guarantee you're all familiar with. They're pretty straightforward, and most of you, I suspect, are familiar with Jesus' comments about that rich man who thought he had it all squared away when he had nothing for eternity. Here's where it really cashes out for me. When I face circumstances in my life that are not satisfying for me, and everybody does that, where investments are not paying off, and I don't mean in the bank or in the stock market. I'm talking about usually in relationships or in things you're trying to accomplish. And this is what Billy Crystal and the rest of the crowd were struggling with as the core concept of this movie, City Slickers. When I wonder about, that's when I say, here's something I can do. I can make some effort right now to put something away forever. So yesterday I was a bit depressed about a number of things that weren't going as I wished, as I wanted, things I prayed about and things that haven't been moving, okay? But I couldn't do anything about that. I couldn't change that circumstance. But what I could do is I could finish writing Solid Ground for January. And it's good I did because I was 2 weeks late on it. So my staff was happy about that. But what was I thinking? I was thinking, I can't move this mountain right in front of me. It's not moving. And it hurts my heart that it's not moving because it's something I want to have moved that's important to me, but I can't do that. I can still do this. I can still do this piece of activity that will accomplish something for the long term, that will pay dividends. And so I did something that's pertaining to my work, of course, but it also is one of those things that's making a contribution long term. And by the way, those contributions long term for me are going to, because the, you know, I'm a writer, for example, and people who keep reading after I'm long gone. I mean, the anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death was, what, November 22nd, so it was just a week ago. And 63, so what is that, like, you know, 57 years ago or something? I'm trying to do my math based on my own birthday, 1950, and I'm not too good at this, but you get the point. And his books are still, like, number one on the evangelism list and apologetics list, okay? So at long after he's gone, that work is still working for the kingdom. Yeah, and then you might be thinking, oh, that's all well and good for C.S. Lewis, or maybe for Kokel, who can write books, but I don't write books. And the point here isn't that you have to do something like that to make that kind of difference. The point is that you do for as unto the Lord, you make a contribution, and that is the thing that gets placed in your account in heaven, earning interest, whether anybody else knows about it or not. And by the way, it turns out that a lot of the very small things that you might be doing in the lives of others could have a huge impact on the kingdom, and you don't even know it. I didn't know that J. Warner Wallace was listening to my radio show when he was an atheist. I didn't know that Abdu Murray was listening to my radio show when he was a Muslim, senior vice president of RZIM now, and, of course, Cold Case Christianity for Jim. I didn't know that. I was just doing my thing. And God used that in these amazing ways. And there are all kinds of things that God does with the small things that we contribute that we don't see. We'll learn later, but not, we don't see now. It doesn't mean that your efforts are for naught. And by the way, if nothing comes from it, that you have done it as unto the Lord is your deposit. So for me now, when I face these hard things, there are a lot of hard things, a lot of things I'm unhappy about, I still can do things that make me feel like I'm making a contribution that matters and that will not be taken away from me. I can still build something of eternal consequence, even though there are other areas of my life that I find are unsatisfying to me and not going the way that I'd hoped. And I think this point of view, this idea that no matter what age we are at, you, me, are at, we can always be making a contribution that has eternal consequence. We are adding to a savings account that can never be taken away, where neither moth nor rust destroy. Thieves cannot break it and steal. It's there for us earning interest. And this is something that can add a tremendous amount of fullness and satisfaction to our life that, you know, I think saves me from the angst of growing older and having regrets and not accomplishing everything that I wanted to in the past and looking at present circumstances and not seeing progress in areas that I really hold valuable in my life and I'd like to see progress. It's not the end of everything. I can still do other things that make a difference. And it's not, I have opportunities that are obvious because of my work. And you may not be in full-time Christian work, but you are in full-time Christian life. And so you have opportunities where you can make those kinds of investments as unto the Lord. And when you do them in good conscience, working hard, being industrious to make a spiritually significant contribution anywhere, that is a treasure in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy, nor thieves break in and steal. And that's what you can look to as being productive activity in your life, even when other things are not going the way you'd like. And this hopefully will, you don't need to go on a cattle drive to figure this one out, or that one thing, as the Jack Palance said in the film, that one thing. All right, let's see, time for a break, and then we'll go to calls here on Stand to Reason.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking, and we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic, and subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRask. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRask is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRask. That's hashtag STRask. All right, friends, a couple of quick things before we go to our patient callers, and that is that we are seeking a, as I mentioned in the past, a new staffer for Stand to Reason, somebody to help us with our, actually, to be our social media coordinator. If you have experience in that, if you have skill in that, we'd love to hear from you. That you have to live in Southern California, that's critical, and you have to experience for a couple of years at least expertise to help run this project that is so important to organizations nowadays. If you want detail on that, str.org/hiring, str.org/hiring, all the details are there. And I just found out that today, Tuesday, usually in my neighborhood it's like Taco Tuesday, but today is actually Giving Tuesday, which is a special day for giving. And December 1st, is the only time of year that I am on the air and ask for help financially. We do this work at Stand to Reason because we're trying to help you, build you up as a follower of Christ, and encourage you. And we have a lot of really wonderful, faithful partners that help us. Giving Tuesday is a day where you can say thank you to those organizations that have helped you or you want to encourage to help others. And I would like you to think about doing that for Stand to Reason. Okay. Let's see. There's, if you go to our website, do we have a button somewhere? I always give to Stand to Reason through the mail, so actually it's automatic deduction for me. But if you want to give, go to str.org, and there's information there that will help you. It says donate, so it's fairly clear. But it's your way of saying thank you to us. It's also your way of participating in the important things that we are that we continually do. So as the month goes on, I'll talk more about end-of-year giving, but just want you to consider us on Giving Tuesday, okay? With that said, let's go to... Okay, now I'm back in the studio, so I got to get my buttons right. Okay, this one right there. That would be Sarah in Flower Mound, Texas. Is that right, Sarah? Do I have you on board? I do, don't I?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Sarah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Just fine. Thank you. Where is Flower Mound?
I think it's about 40 minutes northwest of Dallas.
Oh, okay. Northwest of Dallas. All right. So,
yes.
Got it. Yes. All right. Actually, 40 minutes northwest of Dallas, that's kind of like the right by the Bass Pro Shop, isn't it? Like west of the airport there?
Yeah, Grapevine.
All right, so there you, now I've got a landmark. What's on your mind today, Sarah?
Okay, so I was wondering, since you've studied the Bible a lot, what are there biblical principles or guidelines regarding one government assassinating an individual who's perceived to be a threat to their citizens?
Yeah, you know, this is a very interesting question. It's probably prompted by what happened on Friday, where a nuclear scientist lost his life because he was assassinated by somebody from, we're not sure who did. It probably was the Israelis, okay? So I'm just making a presumption there. It was very well coordinated, and this is a person that was very, very well protected with an entourage of bulletproof vehicles and bodyguards, but still was taken out by these assassins. I think there was 12 of them, 12 or 7, something. It was a good group, a large group is my point.
Yeah, I heard some reports. Yeah, one thought that it was done completely remote controlled. So I don't know exactly what happened.
Well, yeah, and I don't know more of the details, but this is what's prompting your question, okay? So let me just speak in fairly general terms, okay? And the first important thing is that and it's, this is interesting you ask this question, because just last week I saw the Gary Cooper Academy Award winning film Sergeant York about a soldier in the First World War who is decorated, who is a pacifist. And he kept repeating, initially at least, that the book says, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not kill, it's wrong to kill. Well, unfortunately, he was not reading an accurate translation. Because the Ten Commandments, as you know, doesn't say thou shalt not kill, but thou shalt not murder. And what's curious to me that wasn't brought up in the book, and for those people who approach the commandment in that way, is why does it then in the commandment set, and I've just finished, almost finished with Exodus right now, I got two more chapters, there's all kinds of capital crimes that are outlined there in Exodus that said basically if you do these, if a person does this, you cut him off. He shall not be allowed to live. So if it can't say do not kill, but kill. This is a direct contradiction. Why people don't notice that. And then then God sends Israel against enemies to kill them. So it seems, should be pretty obvious that the Bible is not against killing. It's against murder, which is justified killing. So that means there are times when killing is completely justified. And one example would be certain circumstances of capital punishment. Capital punishment is actually taught in the Bible, and there's nothing in the New Testament that says that, that teaches that capital punishment is wrong or ought to be considered wrong. There is no change there. In fact, capital punishment was established in the book of Genesis, chapter 9 and verse 6. So we see it very early, even before the law. So we do have circumstances where it is appropriate to take human lives. Now, when is that? Well, one obvious example is under certain circumstances, the government has authority to do that. And even Paul said, I think it's Paul said that that Caesar does not bear the sword for nothing. So there
right.
is making a reference to not a utensil, artifact that is used for killing, okay? And mm-hmm. and also when he was being charged, he said, if I am guilty of anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. So that's one category of killing that is appropriate, and that is punishment in certain circumstances. But there are other circumstances where it seems clear that killing is legitimate too, and that are circumstances of self-defense. When Israel is being attacked, they can defend themselves, and God sends them out. Actually, God sends them out in some cases, preemptively. In other words, they're the ones who initiate the attack, and they are doing it for a different purpose, okay? And this is what a lot of people will object to. The point I'm making is it's in the Bible, and moral justification for that is another issue, but I'm just making the point that God sometimes affirms a preemptive attack. Now, what I'm not clear on right now, I mean, if I spent some time going through the scriptures, I'm pretty sure I could find examples where Israel preemptively attacked a nation that was a threat to them at the moment. But what Israel did was jump the gun, and they attacked first because of the imminent threat. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, even if I can't find an example of that, I think common sense demonstrates that that's a legitimate type of killing where your life is being threatened, all right, and mm-hmm. you exercise lethal force yourself, okay? So if somebody's coming at you with a knife and you have a gun, you can shoot. Even though you're not being knifed yet, there is a lethal threat that is imminent, and you can respond to that lethal threat. Okay. Now, again, finding Bible verses that say these kinds of things refine the issues this much is going to be a little more difficult because it just doesn't do that. It presumes that some killing is legitimate, and national defense is an example of that, and self-defense is just is national defense on a smaller scale. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So.
Right.
Now, what happened on Friday was a preemptive attack on mm-hmm. a principal, that is an individual who was involved in an operation that represented an existential threat to the nation of Israel. I don't know if you knew this.
Right.
Because,
oh, yes.
Okay, so Iran has, the country of Iran has said many, many times that it is their goal to wipe Israel off the map.
Mm-hmm.
There is no other country that makes this claim now. And the only other country that did make the claim in the past was the Third Reich,
mm-hmm.
which everybody acknowledges was pretty bad. But Hitler, the Final Solution, wanted to wipe out the Jews. Now Iran wants to do the same thing. But they don't need to fight a big battle to do it. All they have to do is drop one nuclear bomb. And there's what, 8 million people who live in Israel? And it wouldn't take much to wipe out the nation as a nation, even though there'd be some survivors, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One on Tel Aviv, one on Jerusalem, that pretty much takes care of it. Okay, so this is what they have pledged to do, and they are involved in working on enriching uranium in order to make the bomb that makes it possible for them to carry out their threat.
Mm-hmm.
And the nuclear scientist was a principal in the process. So the nuclear science himself is an existential threat to the entire nation of Israel. He is an enemy of Israel. And therefore, as an act of national self-defense, presumably they took him out. We don't know for sure, but that seems to make the most sense. So there are circumstances in which it seems morally appropriate, may not be legal with regards to national policy, to take out a leader.
Right. Yeah. No, I just wanted to know what the biblical.
Well, there's the biblical justification. The biblical justification is broad, and that is that killing is allowed under certain circumstances. Okay, mm-hmm. And certainly yeah. National self-defense and personal self-defense would be included in those circumstances. And so circumstances like what we just saw happen on Friday seems to fall in that category, okay? But there isn't a Bible verse where God says it's okay to kill national leaders that are a threat to your country. You don't see that, you know, that kind of thing. You don't see a verse with that kind of clarity. But you do see the Philistines mustering against Israel. And what does David do? David goes out and he kills the leader named mm-hmm. Goliath so as to rout the army and give a victory to Israel and remove the threat. So there you have one person killing another leader who is in a position to bring harm upon the nation. And he's not only heralded as a hero by Israel, by the Hebrews, by his compatriots, but also by God. It was the right thing to do. Okay, and this is the way we answer that question. Now, when in any given situation is it appropriate to do that? This is more difficult. Okay, and so this doesn't create a policy where it's okay to wipe anybody out who's a leader, you know, willy-nilly because we don't like them and we fancy that maybe they're trouble. But these are things that have to be carefully assessed on an individual basis. And I think in the case of the nuclear scientist, I mean, he's a scientist, for goodness sake. He's not a soldier. Wait a minute. He's building a bomb that is meant to destroy a nation. The distinction between scientist and soldier becomes inconsequential at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing was true with Hitler and those that conspired against him. And the conspiracy started in 1938. It's even before, very early on, even the military conspired against him, as well as other Christians. Including... go ahead. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I was going to say. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Christian, had to make this decision, and it cost him his life. And they weren't able to kill Hitler. They made a number of attempts. And they were all kind of strangely foiled. You know, it's just when a bomb went off and blew up and messed up the room and killed some other people, but he survived. So there was a table in the way and it protected him. It was one of those things. But in any event, was it morally justified to attempt to do that? All things considered, definitely in that circumstance.
Okay, because that's a different matter when it's... a civilian assassinating.
Well, I actually don't think it's a different matter if it's a civilian. I don't think being a civilian exempts someone from being the target of an assassination or a killing like that. Military targets seem obvious because military targets are already by definition hostiles. Okay, but civilian targets can be hostiles too. Just as hostile as a military target.
No, I meant the person doing the assassination is a civilian rather than the government.
But that to me is in some circumstances inconsequential. I just heard this on another show earlier today, if you have a neighbor who's building a bomb against you and they're going to blow you up, can you take preemptive action to stop that person, even unto lethal action? And I think most people would say yes. All things being equal, you have a right to protect your own life, and you don't have to wait for the police to take care of it, especially when the police won't do anything to protect you.
That's true, yes.
And in this case,
is there a different consideration if it's they're trying to assassinate a member of your government, though? So it's a governing authority.
Well,
it
all depends on the circumstances, and I think in the circumstance that is in the news at the moment, I don't think there is any moral confusion about the
That's
propriety.
Different.
But I don't want to trade on. what's the word? You don't actually know. You're just I don't want to trade on speculations at this point because it doesn't serve any good purpose. I think what we have to do is encounter the circumstance itself, look at all the angles, and then ask ourselves, is this a morally acceptable alternative in this actual circumstance? And I think in the case of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the answer is yes. And the rest of General Beck and the rest of them that were part of that conspiracy in the Wehrmacht, the military, against Hitler. And I think that this action happening Friday and also the assassination of the military leader, 6 months ago by the United States, one of the ISIS military leaders, I think all of those were justified, morally justified.
That makes sense when you talk about the scientist, his position not being irrelevant, but it's still the level of threat that he poses.
Exactly. He's de facto military at that point. For all intents and purposes, I guess is what I want to say. All righty.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. All right.
Thank you so much.
All right. You're welcome. Let's go to David in, is that number two? Yeah, let's go in David in, I pushed the wrong button, so if I can push the whole button. Yeah, that's where. Okay, David. There we go. I was at Lucas for a minute. I pushed the wrong button. David in Springboro, Ohio, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg.
Hey.
Hey, my question, I've had this question brought to me by a couple of people.
Yeah.
That they're missing books from the Bible.
Right.
And then this morning I got the question, why is the Book of Enoch not in the Bible? So just how would... the appropriate way to respond to that.
Okay. It's easier to respond to the first rather than the second. And the simple answer to the second question is because the early Christians did not understand it at the time to be of like authority to the other scriptures. And I don't think that even the Jews did not consider that to be inspired scripture. So this is why it's not in the canon. I mean, that's not a whole lot of information, but I don't have like a lot of background in that book, okay? But this does relate to the first question, and that one's easier to answer, but it depends on the definition of a word. But let me pause for a minute and just mention that I actually wrote a piece about this question, and it was like, are there lost books in the Bible or something about the Bible's lost books or something like that? And I think it's on our website, just so you know. But I'll give you a quick summary of the point there, okay? A lot depends on, well, let me back up and put it this way. The answer to the question is no. And I can say it with confidence because it is not possible for there to be lost books of the Bible. This is the key. Now, it depends on what you mean by Bible, and so I'll clarify. There can be lost books of antiquity, no question, and they come up with new things now and again. They discover these things. In fact, something was discovered about 5 years ago or so, the Gospel of Judas or something like that, and I have a book about it. But we knew it existed even before they found it because the early church fathers talked about it existing and being pseudepigrapha, false writings. In other words, this is a phony, so don't trust this thing, and then we found it. So there are books that from antiquity that we discover. Here's the question. The question is whether these are actually lost books of the Bible. Okay, now it depends on what one means by the Bible, and there are two ways to define the Bible. Either the Bible is the books that God himself inspired for use by his people, okay? And that would be a Christian understanding and a Jewish understanding of the Hebrew Scriptures. That what could be what we mean by the Bible. Or we could mean that all the Bible is, and this would be a more secular look, all the Bible is a collection of books that a group of people in the early part of the first millennium decided were books that represented the theology of their own religion. Okay? So now I'm just speaking in a purely secular way. These are people that, so the term Bible could refer to a supernaturally inspired book or not. And then it just simply means that collection of books that the early Christians owned as the books that best described the theology that they held to. All right? Now, in neither of those ways of characterizing the word Bible can there be lost books of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So let's just take the first one, the idea that, well, the Bible is that collection of books that God purposefully inspired, God breathed, for an authoritative set of volumes for the church for all time. Okay? Can there be lost books from there? Well, that would mean, since on that definition of the Bible, God is in charge with inspiring the Bible and keeping the right books as the books the Christians recognize, that would mean God lost one of his own books.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so it can't be that God lost his books. Mm-hmm. If we are talking about the Bible as the divinely inspired word of God, God doesn't lose his divinely inspired word. He guarantees not only the reliability of the individual words in the text, but also the existence and the perseverance and collection of the books that contain the words.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so canon, the books that are supposed to be in the Bible, the rule, the R-U-L-E, the authority, authoritative rule, those books that are authoritative, that's just a subset of inspiration. So God inspires the books and then protects the books he inspired.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what the Bible is, then God can't lose his books. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Okay? So let's just say, on the one hand, from the Christian perspective, you can't have lost books.
Right.
Now, what about, let's just say an atheist say, well, wait a minute. No, that's just your Christian view. I don't hold to your Christian view. I hold to another view. I'm not a Christian. I don't think God inspired anything. I think these were leaders in the early first couple of centuries that decided these are the books they like, and they excluded other books they didn't like, and that was their Bible. So they left out these other books, and some of these other books have come up. And now we've discovered these other Gnostic Gospels, for example, the Gospel of Thomas or right. others like that. My response is, there what? Well, there, see, these are lost books of the Bible. Wait a minute. The way you just described Bible in that sense was the books that these people thought were authoritative for them. Apparently, they didn't think the Gospel of Thomas was authoritative for them. That's why they didn't include it. So it may be a lost book of antiquity, but it can't be a lost book from the Bible, because the people at the time get to decide for themselves which books represent their view. And if they didn't like Thomas, they can toss Thomas or anything else they want to toss, because they are making their own Bible. So the point I'm making now is that there can't, even on a secular understanding of the word Bible, there can't be any lost books, because those early Christians understood which books they believed represented their view. And the ones that got tossed for whatever reasons, it was their choice to toss.
Right.
I mean, for that matter, anybody could make their own Bible up. This is my Bible. These are the books that I decide that are my Bible, the books I think are righteous and good and define my own view. So this is my Bible. Well, fine, you're welcome to it. But there can't be any lost books of your Bible, because there's all the ones you chose. They're still there. If somebody else finds something else, you say, well, it's not in my Bible. If that's all the Bible is, it's just a book by men gathered to reflect their own personal views.
Mm-hmm.
So the point I'm making now is then, in answer to the question, can there be lost books of the Bible? My answer is no. if the Bible is a divinely inspired book, God can't lose his books. That doesn't make sense. And if the Bible is humanly constructed, then the people who constructed it with their books.
Mm-hmm.
They put their own books in their Bible. And any other books weren't in their Bible because they get to decide what books are in their Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other books that existed then that we don't know about that all of a sudden we find, we dig them out somewhere in the sand? Sure. But that doesn't mean they're lost books of the Bible. That just means they're lost books. That's all it means. Mm-hmm. Books that we now discover that we hadn't had in the past. But
yeah.
In many cases, they weren't lost to the early Christians because they knew what they knew they were around. And they rejected them as being false, as characterizations of the life of Jesus in the case of alleged gospels, like the Gospel of Judas or something like that, or the Gospel of Thomas. No, these were writings of heretics, and the early Christians acknowledged them as such and condemned them as heretical. That's why we can know about some of these things before they're even discovered, and then we discover them. Oh, yeah, well, now we know. There it is, but we already knew because the early Christians wrote about them.
Mm-hmm.
So does that make sense to you as an explanation?
Yeah. Do you have any resources other than the article recommends for me to look further?
No, that's it. I'm the only one that I know of who've written about are there lost books. But I think I think the answer entails a conceptual understanding, okay? And this is my last comment here because we're just about done with our segment. And that is that it's either a Bible is either this or it's that. And in either case, however you define it, supernaturally or naturally, by the definition itself, there cannot be any lost books of that Bible. There can be lost books of antiquity, but not of the Bible. I'd say check it out online. Amy hasn't given me a source or anything, but it'll probably be in the notes for the show. Anyway, there's my music, and that's it for this session. Hey, thanks so much for your call, David, and great question. I haven't had it in a long time. Glad to answer it. I'm Greg Kochel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.